Welcome back, everyone. This is Eric Elveson with the Digital Education Podcast, where I get to have conversations with educators, leaders, innovators, really ultimately, in a lot of ways, people who've been incredibly generous to me, not only with their time, expertise, but also their friendship. And I'm back today with number three. This is the third podcast I've done with Rex Miller. And Rex, we've had the opportunity to talk about the MindShift process in the past. The second podcast I did with you was a preview, actually, to the book that was released, you know, just recently. But for those who don't know Rex, he's the principal for MindShift, a leading futures consultancy, human performance coaching, and organizational strategy company. And then the book, and we'll give people more information on this and connect them with it. The new book from the most recent project is called Whole, What Teachers Need to Help Students Thrive. And Rex, one of the things I've learned, you know, from you in the MindShift process is you start with a wicked problem. But it seems like as I read the book and as I went through the book, the wicked problem that you started with was not actually the wicked problem that you actually really truly discovered. Can you kind of, you know, share with us how you got to that place and what the aha moment or the realization was that maybe you were thinking or looking in the wrong place?
Sure. So first of all, for those who may not know what a wicked problem is, you can look it up at Wikipedia, but it's not something evil. But a wicked problem, it's a problem that isn't solved easily, that resists change. It's very complex with lots of interworking pieces. And when you try to solve an aspect of it, it usually creates unintended negative consequences. And it therefore stays stuck for a long time. So part of what we look at is we try to look at areas that are stuck. Like in humanizing the education machine, it was in student engagement. It's been stuck for a long time, just like worker engagement. And it was interesting, I looked at Gallup's most recent study that goes back to 2000 on global engagement, and those numbers have remained constant since, in terms of 30% of employees and teachers are happy and engaged, self-motivated, give their best. 50% are unhappy. They go through the motions. They'll do a decent job if you tell them what to do, tell them how to do it, and then follow up and make sure they did it. And then 20% are toxic. In fact, I heard somebody give an analogy that if your organization was a soccer team and you had 10 people on the team, two of them would be trying to score against you. That's the toxic. So that was, you know, that's the consistent thread through the workplace books we did, then the education, humanizing the education machine. Then corporately, we started looking at the issue of wellness because it was becoming a topic of interest. And we dove into that in the workplace. And we came away with a huge ahas. So we start each of these projects with the assumptions that wellness is the solution to the workplace for rising health costs and helping people be happier and more engaged. 6 months into that project, we had to throw that out the window. And actually, I had to go back to everybody and say, look, everything we thought about wellness is wrong. It fundamentally does not work. Any wellness program that an organization, a school, company has does not reduce costs, does not improve health outcomes. So now what do we do? We get to two places in our research. One is the oh my God factor. When we see how big the problem is, you know, 60% of students by 12th grade are disengaged, 70% of teachers. That's an oh my God factor. The other is, so what do we do now? Everything we thought about what the problem was doesn't fit the paradigm. So now where do we go? And so we reached that in the corporate space and started realizing that the real problem to the health issue is something called chronic disease. It's the rise of chronic disease. And there's two kinds. There's the kinds that that you have, like multiple sclerosis or something like that, that's just part of your, you know, the random luck or the genetics. And then there's lifestyle, and that's the majority. And then what we saw is that the primary problem is the chronic issues that are long-term, high cost, and that's 80% of our health costs is chronic disease. And so if you take a $3.5 trillion and look at 80% of that being chronic disease, the natural conclusion, if you're a wellness program, is we need people to improve their lifestyle, eat better, exercise, move, you know, limit drugs, alcohol, stop smoking, all of that. Those are the things that lead to chronic disease. What we discovered, none of the programs to do that work. And then, and so if the other big, oh my God, factor is that right now, 50% of the nation has some form of chronic disease. And it's in the teacher core as well. And if 50%, that's a norm, by the way, once you get over 50%, then that becomes what we call a norm. It's rising at 7% compounded rate. And that's been one of those things that's been stuck since the 1970s. So it's been rising 7 to 10% a year. So that's the driver of health costs. It's as bad as the healthcare system is, as evil as you think the pharmaceutical industry may be, that's minute, because if this other thing doesn't get fixed, none of that matters. So moving through the healthy workplace nudge, we started asking, so what's the real driver behind chronic disease? And we found this thing called stress, something I'm sure teachers don't know anything about, you know, stress. And what we traced is that what are the behaviors that lead to that that stress creates? You smoke. You drink more alcohol, or you take more drugs. You take sleeping pills. You binge watch, you know, Netflix. You don't have the energy or the resolve to get out socially or to get up and exercise or do those things. You're just wiped out at the end of the day. So that's what's happening. And teachers are more susceptible, and we'll talk about, because they're in a particularly high risk industry, which they may not even have realized that it's the fourth highest risk profession in the country. So what we saw is that we have to get to root cause, the villain, stress, chronic stress, and then we have to deal with human nature. So that came out of Healthy Workplace Nudge. Now, the segue, and I know this is a long segue, the segue is, so what about teaching? So we walked into, I go to a workshop for educators from one of the companies, high-tech companies from Nudge. They provide pro bono leadership training for educators. And this was a group from all over the country. And it was an incredible environment and incredible people who came. And it's by invitation only. So these are, you know, they try to do high need areas with people who are going to be early adopter leaders in their area. And this particular company is big on wellness, and they have a wellness director. And the wellness director took all the teachers through a resilience assessment. And I won't go into the details. It's in the book. The bottom line, on the last day, once they compiled the results of the wellness, of the resilience assessments, and they did three, they came back to the group very first thing in the morning, said, we missed the whole importance, and we want to take a break to see if we're really providing you what you need. We've shown you all this great stuff that you can do, new ways of leading, but this is the least resilient group we've ever worked with. And all this great stuff doesn't matter if you don't have the capacity to go into the battle, so to speak. And so they described that 75% of these teachers were in survival mode. And the owner actually said, or the founder actually said, we don't know how you get up in the morning based on how low you rated. They said 25% of you are in startled mode, which means you're ready to pop at any given time. So I'm immediately going, oh my gosh, he's describing fight or flight, survival, you know, fight or flight, chronic stress. This thing is on all the time. But I watched the body language because I wasn't participating in, I was an observer. I watched people, teachers' shoulders slump. I saw breathing and sighing. And then I heard people start, the catharsis started. One person said, so I'm not supposed to feel like crap every day. And they describe that what happens in the body is that you begin to adapt to this lower capacity range, and it's called suboptimized. You know, you're suboptimal, but it feels normal. So they've even lost the physical and mental reference point of what normal looks and feels like. And he concluded by saying, you need recovery times 1,000. I'm watching this and thinking, this does not align with me with what Gallup says about teachers. It doesn't align that they're disengaged, which implies that they don't care. What it looks more like is battle fatigue, depression, secondary trauma, burnout. And on the surface, it looks like disengagement. I called one of the underwriters and co-authors for the research, Bill Latham, at Meteor. He's the president of Meteor Education. And I said, Bill, this is what I'm seeing. This is what I'm thinking. I don't think it's an engagement problem. I don't think these teachers don't care. I think they care too much. I think it's a caregiver's dilemma that they're wired to take care of others. But what's happened is that they're in this new war zone of a bottomless pit of need. And there's nothing out there to take care of them. And Bill's comment was, if that is true, then we've been spending millions and millions and millions of dollars trying to solve the wrong problem. So that launched the new research. So I know that was a long ramp up to that, but that's what got us into the new research.
No, I mean, and it's incredible to think. I mean, and that's the one thing I appreciate about you is the curiosity to be able to ask the questions and to be able to start at a place where it's, you know, it's looking at disengagement because you know, I've done a lot of that research and follow a lot of that, and a lot of that is part of even my work of, you know, what I do on a daily basis with students and with their careers and with their futures of, you know, what's going to engage them and how people, you know, even in my profession, and you've chosen to kind of focus in on my profession, you know, in multiple of these books, you know, the Humanizing the Education Machine, and now this book Whole. And it's just fascinating to me because I've seen this over the course of my 20 plus year career, where I've watched, I think probably three things, and I'm interested, and there'll be a question at the end of this. I've watched as number one is, you know, as people have dropped out of the profession, you know, friends of mine who are really good at it. Two, I think the other thing is people that, you know, now I'm at a certain age where people are just trying to survive to the end because they can see the end of their careers or retirement coming. And even like, you know, a pivot in their life once they get to that spot. Or even the third place where, you know, I think even the research is, You know, it used to be, you know, 20 years ago that education was a highly preferred profession, and teacher ed programs were full. And now what you see is, you know, stay away. And even parents are saying, you know what, I don't want my kid to become a teacher and an educator. And you mentioned some things just about the workplace in general that go back to 1970, but did you uncover like any of the underlying nature to, you know, in your last project with Humanizing the Education Machine, but then with the Well-Being Project, and now with this project, did you come up with the underlying reasons of why, you know, especially in this case, the education system has become such a grinder to people's health and well-being?
Well, so I think there's one, the structure of education. So when you're working in an obsolete model, let's think of Paul Bunyan. You know, you can be the best teacher, but if you're using an axe to cut down trees, the little wimp with a chainsaw is going to still beat you. And so what's happened is, and we covered this in Humanizing, that the model of education is still primarily a Gutenberg model. You know, a batched, aged model where everybody learns the same thing at the same time with the teacher up front, memorizing content, and then taking tests. And in the world that we now live in, there's no company that operates like that. I shouldn't say no company, but business doesn't operate like that. You know, Bill Gates wrote a book years ago called Business at the Speed of Thought. You know, agile, real time, distributed, on demand, pull versus push. So when you've got teachers going upstream and trying to produce a product that works in the world, but they're doing it with something that's obsolete, that's just a lot more work and effort. It's tons more effort. And then the other big change has been the social needs. One of the common things we heard across the board in every school, what we heard is kids are not coming to school ready to learn. And what they meant by that is they don't have the social and emotional skills. They're not equipped with the social and emotional skills to sit still, to cooperate, to work in groups, to take initiative, to be curious, to be playful and fun. And a lot of these kids are coming out of environments that are emotionally chaotic, you know, at needs. And then we've got, you know, in Humanize, we identified that 50% of kids are being left behind, 25% because of social emotion, because of economic and demographics, and 25% because of learning differences, ADHD, OCD, anxiety, Asperger's, all of these things. And so the batch Gutenberg system has no way to deal with what we call one-off kids. They have to batch kids. And so that's a new phenomenon too. So if you've got 50% of your kids coming in that don't work in an industrial batch, you know, production model, that's huge stress. And how many teachers do you know that were trained in, first of all the social emotional capabilities, you know, to read kids and to reduce tension and to de-escalate conflict and all of that, and manage a classroom, and handle all the different learning levels that kids are at? The cognitive and emotional load, which we measured through a band called WHOOP, so you can use that as a future question. The cognitive and emotional load, the stress, the demand, is equivalent to high performance professional athletics in terms of load on the body, on your central nervous system. And so all of the strain and stress to have to do things that they're not trained for. So it's a reboot. It's a reset time to consider what is the new metaphor and model for school. And in whole, we looked at the new metaphor and model as in asking the questions, are schools becoming the new field hospitals in America? So those are the, that's, we're in this grinder because of those two key phenomenons.
So one of the questions I wanted to ask you, and you know, in this, you give a number of recommendations, of self-care and of wellness and of what can be done as we think about, you know, and it's an interesting kind of paradigm shift, right, to look at schools as these field hospitals, for our cultures, our society, our community, and it probably means even more, you know, at this period of time. But one of the things I was wondering about, and I know I didn't necessarily prep you for this, but one of the things about high stress that they talk about, you know, or that I've done a lot of research on is that, you know, a sense of self-efficacy. If I have a sense of self-efficacy or a sense of control right. over my environment or over my setting or of my situation, you know, no matter if it's high stress, it can be managed and it can be managed well and I can live. But when that sense of self-efficacy or control goes away, then all of a sudden it skyrockets, and that's where you have a lot of these problems. And I'm just wondering, you know, based on what you've seen, do you see that teachers or educators feel like they have control over their environments or over their situation, or are they just in a consistent state of triage?
Yeah. So two things. One, out of 200 schools we talked to, only one was providing social emotional care and training to their teachers. And this was the Momentous Institute. So they said the same care, so there's a lot of resources for kids on training for social emotional literacy. But Dr. Gasco said, if you train teachers in that, but don't do the work, the internal work, if they're not getting their own self-care during this, you're actually increasing the pressure and stress on them to deliver something that they don't have themselves. So that's number one. Number two, we saw schools that had highly engaged, you know, when we went to Canada and saw a couple of those schools, and Canyon View High School in outside of Phoenix. But the difference was that these were more project-based, team-based, inquiry-based schools where the environments were flexible. The mindset had shifted to this collective learning as opposed to one person being in charge of the learning. So they distributed the learning and the stress to the collective. And it was a mind shift change. It was a structure change. It was an environment change. It was a skill change. And you saw happy, engaged, thriving teachers, thriving students, and you know, they didn't get there overnight. Lee Elementary is another incredible one. You know, the concept there is that it's 700 kids in an elementary school broken into five what they call houses. Each house is a grades 1 through 5. So each house has all the teachers for 1 through 5, all the kids in a common area, and think of the community it builds, think of the continuity of kids with the same kids year after year and the same teachers year after year. You know, so it's a thriving school, it's a model school, it certainly breaks the paradigm. And there's a lot of people that remember in the 70s, this open classroom thing that was a disaster, but it works. And, but they designed for it to work. And we have different design capabilities and understanding and technology to support that, that we didn't have in the 70s. So shifting that burden, shifting that load has to be done. You know, Lou Cozzolino out of Pepperdine talks about creating that tribal nature, that tribal structure, where we're doing this collectively and together. But you can't do it in a Gutenberg framework, you know, the sage on the stage.
So let me ask you a question, because I think it's, and you know, and I think maybe Two more questions, and this one has kind of got two parts to it, because I think it's really interesting that you talk about systems, but then within the system you talk about, and I've always appreciated you, and you've kind of opened my eyes to this idea of finding the bright spots, right, in a dark world. And so you've opened, you know, the opportunity for me to even to be a small part of, you know, this project, and to visit a school like, you know, the Da Vinci School down in the LA area, and to see a bright spot in a darker world. And so you look at the system, and one of the things that I keep thinking about, and I'll ask you maybe in two parts, one for school leaders, right, as they think about it, is what are maybe a couple of the tips that you learned and said, hey, if you want to create this tribal system, if you want to create the us factor, if you want to create this collective nature that draws us together and allows us to care for each other and do this hard work, what would be those tips? And then and then I think one of the things I'm interested in about, because especially at a system wise, are especially policymakers, legislators, philanthropists, who have come in over the last 20 years and said to the system, this is what you need to do. And they brought bureaucratic approaches that oftentimes limit the creativity, the innovation that you're talking about in some of these places, some of these bright places. So somewhat of a two-part question, but what would be the tips, you know, to kind of both sides?
Yeah, so first of all, the first thing educators need to understand is best practices don't work. Best practices work in a system that has continuity and everybody's kind of moving, but because everything is so contextually based, every community, I mean, your community is different than my community. So what may have worked in your community, I can't then import into mine. I have to recontextualize it. So the way that is done, and I learned this by reading the work of Jerry Sternum, who was an NGO doctor after the Vietnam War and was brought in to help the poverty and the high mortality rate in infants because of lack of nutrition. And so he had all kinds of constraints, so he couldn't operate as a typical bureaucratic NGO. And he was given a very short, truncated time frame to come up with a solution. And what he did is he went to the villages and he divided the mothers up into three categories: poor, very poor, and extremely poor. And then he looked for any healthy babies. So this is where the bright spots come from. He looked for healthy babies in the extremely poor and then wanted to find out what they were doing differently. And when he found out, and basically what they were doing is they were breaking social norms. And the social norms were to feed your kids three times a day, not give them any protein. That was for adults. And in the ones breaking the social norms were feeding smaller portions more times a day. They were taking the little shrimp in the rice patties and chewing those up a bit to break them down and putting them into the rice. Those kids were healthier. But instead of the NGO coming in and training people, now we know the formula, let's train you. They took these mothers who were part of the tribe, part of the context, and they facilitated them teaching the others how to cook. So that's a little bit of a metaphor. Columbus, Indiana, is an area that has developed a process very similar. It's called a stakeholder process. So number one, it's not going to be solved by experts who come in as heroes. Now, you may need experts, but they have to become guides. And what they do is they take the collective knowledge and the people who really know the context, and then you go and find those outliers, and you reverse and you figure out what it is, and then you experiment with them, with the stakeholders, and help them develop the prototypes. And in every group, you have some bright spots. You have some teachers in every school that are doing things a little differently, rearranging the desks and getting better results or whatever it is. So anywhere there's a bright spot, you can start there and begin to expand it And in the adoption curve, you'll have people who are eager for something new. You'll have people who are doing something different. Then you'll have people who are eager for something new. Then you'll have some people who are on the fences. Then you'll have the skeptics. And then you've got the people who are going to die doing what they've always done and not move. So you kind of identify who is in those buckets, and you begin to gradually expand into each bucket to do it strategically, to bring change. You know, that's a different version, a different way to explain the mind shift process, but that's what leaders can do. And it's very powerful to go and see. We had a group go to Holland, Michigan, and one of your colleagues, Dan Behrens, facilitated our ability to see five different schools. And in each school, there were different bright spots. And then we collectively came back together and just looked at the implications and how would you do it. So getting out of your context is so important. Even when we did with your group, went to San Jose and saw Bulldog Tech and saw your school, that fresh thinking stimulates conversation. The other part too that's easy to do is get conversation started, use book clubs, you know, whether it's Lou Cozzolino's book or Michael Horn's books or Tony Wagner's books or our books. Any of those is a proxy to get the conversation started. And once it gets started, certain people will just kind of give it a life of its own and take it forward.
So in that context, we're in a massive pivot point. And you've used the word, even before this, I use your term pivot, right? And, you know, and I think about what Bill and you have taught me, Bill Latham, and you have taught me that often innovation, change comes through pain, right? And comes through just disruption, right? Some things that we just are out of our control. And I've watched that in my career in some ways, positive, negative ways, but we're pretty much a complete and huge disruption. I'm blessed with a lot of friends who are school leaders and that are, you know, making the massive pivot. And we had a meeting in LA 3 weeks ago and we could see it coming. And so we kind of did that. We started to do some of that prep and started to kind of think through, like, if you put your futurist hat on and the experience that you've been through with humanizing, the experience you went through with the workplace nudge, the experience that even going back to the Millennium Matrix, and now with this book Whole, like, what do you see on the back end of this? What do you see coming? What are some of the things that, you know, you predict, but then maybe even some of the things that you would encourage people to lean into?
Well, so before there is kind of this sea change revolution, whatever you want to call it, the pieces have been in place. So think of the Gutenberg model. You know, it's 450, almost 500 years old. It built Western civilization. It built the industrial infrastructure we have. Companies are going to be hitting the wall on this as well. There's typically something that becomes that critical igniting point where you go from kind of seasonal, you know, adaptations to a sea change. And everybody's going to be in one of the five stages of grief in terms of the sea change. But we're not going back to the new normal. I don't think in business. I don't think in healthcare. I don't think in education. The opportunity, the hidden opportunity, is not to try to get back to normal, but to look at what's going on. And I think what's going on is that we're decoupling ourselves from the batch model of education where everybody has to come to one place and learn the same thing at the same time, test the same way, to a world with the capability of doing mass customized learning. Distributed mass customized learning. Now we know the pieces are in place. We know there are some schools already doing this. We know internationally that because of the constraints they have, you know, in Africa, that some of these countries and capabilities, you know, Dr. Eric Hamilton out of Pepperdine has been working in this mode in Africa for a long time because they don't have the luxury of transportation, everybody coming to the same place. I think it's going to accelerate that. And people are going to be doing it out of a risk mitigation mindset first. You know, how do we not, how do we get meals to people, kids that depend on it? You know, how do we make sure kids stay on their lesson programs? Nobody's really thinking about how is this the new model of education so that Jimmy, who's here in math, and Susie, who's here in math, can now have their own path. And Susie, who's here in music, and Jimmy, who's here in music, can have their own path. And the teacher being fully empowered and capable of managing five times the student population than they're currently managing. That's the possibility. That's the future. And we'll have to reimagine and repurpose what a building is for. You know, how do we use these buildings? And maybe they become more community re-education centers and community gathering places like town halls that we used to do. And there becomes this more blurred, fluid learning, you know, learning capacity and facility empowerment, engagement with a complete rethinking of it. And that's probably so far out of where people's anxiety levels are now to even think about that. But that's, I think, what's on the other side.
I think, you know, so much of that, you know, it's really interesting to watch even how individual schools, you talk about how individual schools, you know, are the bright spots in some of these organizations and some of these programs. And you have, you know, definitely that global perspective. And so I really appreciate it. So if people want to connect with you and they want to learn more about this book and they want to think more deeply, and maybe here in the coming weeks, I mean, it's very likely that, you know, many places will not be going back to school this year. Like, what are the ways that people can get connected with you, can think through, you know, even the work that you put into this book, or even just kind of go deeper and say, hey, you know what, on the back end of this, I want to think about how we can maybe make a pivot and do things different. How can they connect with you, and what's coming with some of the book stuff?
So www.hope.school has both books there and introduction videos to all the books and the opportunity to order comic books if you want. And it's still a work in progress because we're updating it because the new book just came out. But it's ready. It's available. You can at least start there. If you want to hear the daily posts of what I – and my posts are really – information-based, relevant leadership material for now, and that's on LinkedIn. So I use LinkedIn a lot. My website is www.rexmiller.com, and that's just to get to know us as a leadership organization. We really, so there's two things that my firm focuses on. One is what we call people puzzles. Leaders and managers struggle solving people puzzles. Because of that, 70% of employees, teachers and employees, are either unhappy or toxic. So, you know, we've got lots of experience with great tools in helping solve people puzzles. The second thing we do is we help leaders and organizations and projects get through crisis. Because that's typically when I'm called in. So we've been solving what you might call episodic crisis or existential crisis in organizations for more than 10 years. And helping leaders understand that their primary job in crisis is to get through the five stages of grief so they can see the new adventure forward and bring that positive energy. That's what we help leaders do, accelerate that coming to terms with what's happened so that they can get beyond and lead their people.
Rex, I really appreciate your time with me today. And I look forward to getting this information out there, sharing it with people, and then the conversations that will come because of it, because I know, you know, your work and just the relationship that I've developed with you has just allowed me to enter into some really amazing places.
Thank you, Eric. I appreciate the time. We're going to get through this, and I am going to be extremely fascinated on what fall looks like when school begins again.